tape 3 for May 8, 2006, the third session, third part.
Right. And you were just saying that you're the Vedic or the prophet of the fusion technology. And my question to you is, are you predicting the inevitable, or are you having an effect in terms of helping to bring it about by, well, I don't know, language is very powerful. We're talking about this. Is it, you know, adding to Sheldrake call it, the genetic, morphogenetic field, and thus helping to bring about this transition to the negentropic world of fusion technology? Are you participating in bringing it about, or are you just prophesizing the inevitable?
Well, we've got a lot of different memes historically to interpret to answer that question. There are some who say, you know, yes, what we think we energize creates. There's others who say, no, it has nothing to do with it, and it's up to political decision. Others would say, no, technology is unfolding inevitably, you know, from speech, writing, to movies, to television, which extends the central nervous system and the satellite extension of the planet. There's, like, in retrospect, a chronological inevitability. So from that point of view, it's going to be inevitable we'll have cold fusion. So I am aware of each way of looking at it, and I'm not going to make a decision about which is the most likely. I would say a bit of all those three views I just stated. I'm energizing it, I'm seeing it's inevitable, and I know we've got to fight for it.
Yeah, okay.
Which is in the gap.
Yeah.
We are all in the gap. We're in so intercommunication with so many technologies and cultures today that we're all in the gap. And you got to recognize that. That's part of media yoga. So you wouldn't identify with any position, but you wouldn't deny any position. And you would support anybody who was fanatic about one of the positions, at least to the extent you're around them, right? You can support a competing view when you're around that person and not around the previous person. So it's metaphysical promiscuity. It's mass hypocrisy we're all forced to engage in because we're putting on so many different contexts and audiences all the time. Now, people aren't aware of this, so they get embarrassed, you know what I mean, by what their actions seem to be leading towards, and then it doesn't turn out that way, and they thought they represented one point of view. I mean, as McLuhan said, to not have a point of view is a necessary way of navigating. That means not identifying, being imaginative, and not identifying with any particular environment you're in at that point, which would then agree with LaRouche.
Well, it's hard to fight for something where you don't have a point of view about it.
Well, by just talking about it, you're fighting for it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to get out there and start a fight on the street with somebody, but if I get on Eben tomorrow and talk about it, which I've done many times, that's a kind of fight within the software environment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a propagandist for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just making an interesting point there. What was it? I was saying how this becomes LaRouche's idea. I'm not identifying with any technological direction, trend, embed, environment, or milieu, and they are sensory, extensions of our senses, so I'm platonic, not identifying with the immediate environments, though that may look hypocritical when I'm encountering other environments, and they say, well, I noticed you with the previous environments. You're promiscuous.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it interesting that you can use the detached LaRouche method in expanding McLuhan's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Or that McLuhan is saying the same thing. He defines imagination as that faculty that's not embedded in any senses or extensions of the senses. It's interesting. People consider McLuhan was an Aristotelian.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually was a platonic in the sense of detachment.
Mm-hmm.
But of course he was in the gap, and he was working with east, west, north, south, all of them.
Right.
Like Joyce wasn't finning his wake.
And then there was Gurdjieff who seemed to put down the imagination, thinking that it was that it only absorbed you in some sort of something that was untrue, and that there was objective reality.
Objective reality
could be perceived, and imagination was like masturbating and took you away from the perception of objective reality.
Yeah, he talked about objective art versus subjective art, and most Western art was subjective art from his point of view, inferior art.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that that discussion?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, and, well, you just take the word. I mean, we don't have Gurdjieff here, so you would then analyze his words, but I don't want to get distracted with that.
Sure.
I mean,
yeah.
Some ways he was a tribal oral guy, totally infatuated with 19th century objectivity. You know what I mean? And so he was romanticizing what to him was a novelty but was old-fashioned for a Western man.
Yeah.
That's if I just take the word objectivity. He probably has some unique meaning of it. He might mean the detachment of the private citadel of consciousness. There's all kinds of different ways that we could take what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But with different audiences, I would interpret that objectivity differently for whoever I want to be in any environment or merge with
mm-hmm.
when the topic of Gurdjieff came up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Among Gurdjieffians, I'd say that he was, just to be in any environment to them, I'd say he was a tribal guy totally enraptured with the 19th century and thought it was the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because his emphasis on movement, it's kinetic space. That was all extended by muscular industrial technology.
Yeah, really? Yeah, that's great.
Okay, so so you see what I mean by drives and instincts, that they are, they're terms in psychology that are updated terms of being sensuously controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a deeper meaning of sensuously controlled. It's the whole body image that one has that LaRouche is referring to in terms of sensuously controlled. You know, it's not a moralistic statement. It is a technological determinist kind of condition,
mm-hmm.
which he wouldn't advocate.
Yeah.
So then we go on to, shall we do the next quote that goes into page 6 but starts at the bottom of page 4?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless you want to take a break and go into McLuhan.
No, well, let's do this quote, then we'll get to McLuhan.
Okay. So just to emphasize from the last paragraph this important point, that the process associated with creative mentation is the primary substance.
Now, it's important he puts that in quotes, because he does not want to say it is the primary substance. That would just be another category that everybody would repeat like robots, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a temporary primary substance, because he knows the primary substance is like tactility. You can't put your finger on it.
Mm. Okay.
He writes that very carefully.
Yeah.
Because he's to say something is a primary substance, that's like saying it's a drive. That's a category, a visual bias category that he is trying to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, he's like, this is the oral method. He's making a point, but the conversation will lead to the opposite point as the interchange carries on. You'll find that in speech, that people say something, then you discuss it, and if you start to agree with them, they might shift off to, well, I mean, another way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's the blocking and merging I have at the beginning of Cloning ESP, that essay. We block and we merge. And the blocking and merging dialectic or interplay is very well expressed in the speech medium as you watch how people interact. Everyone, you know, knows you have a deep conversation with somebody, and like there's interest in what you're saying for a while, and they like it, they get inspired. But at a certain point, they will say, I don't completely agree with where you're taking that. That's when they begin to assert their own individuality again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a common pattern in conversations, that a dialogue will start off, interests one person presenting something, the other person's interested, partly because they want to be stimulated.
And they want to have some mutual participation in the conversation.
Yeah. But push comes to shove, they eventually will say, well, we disagree on that point. You know, if the person making the point and the topic as the catalyst is laying something out, and then if you don't want to get to the point where, yeah, you're right, we're all going to follow you, I'm going to go home and live with you, you know what I mean? Or start hanging out with you. At a certain point, this average rational citizen will detach himself so he doesn't have to become a victim.
Mm-hmm.
Or a cult victim, so to speak.
Yeah.
Doesn't want to be subject to propaganda. Now, that's the visual biased person.
Mm-hmm.
Tribal cultures, they want to merge. They want everybody to agree.
Yeah.
And they won't disagree. They don't have a point of view like that. They don't have a point of view to assert. They become Japanese robots, as they're presented in his old movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
One mind, the tribal integrated mind.
Yeah.
Bound by personal loyalty and tribal totems.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So, finishing up page 4, overflowing into page 6.
And you, if you had the book, you'd go, you'd read this first sentence, and then you'd go to page 5, and you'd see there's a whole disconnected quote, and it seems like it doesn't finish. The sentence is incomplete, but then you turn to page 6, and you'll see the sentence that Scott's going to read continues. But it's interrupted on page 5 by a bunch of McLuhan quotes.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the book looks.
Right. A certain crude empirical conception of physical science did, of course, exist prior to and following Kepler. But the advantage of Kepler over, for example, the outlook of Galileo is qualitative, not one of degree. Before Kepler, as with those who maintained or regressed to the pre-Keplerian thrust towards empiricism, the notion of the study of the regular order of nature was pluralistic. That's in quotes. Various categories of phenomena were treated as if separate categories of the divine will, within which narrow confines man could explore regularity through observation and experiment, hoping thereby to adduce the specific regularity of God's will or dispensation for such classes of phenomena. Kepler cut through such pathetic forms of inquiry, specifying that the entire universe was subject to a single principle of lawfulness, which subsumed all other, more particular forms of law. Kepler expressed this view in the argument that God's infinite or unique comprehensive existent will was rational.
Kepler expressed this view in the argument that God's infinite, i.e. unique, comprehensive, existent will was rational, italicized.
Susceptible of being mastered as human knowledge and of even human individuals.
Susceptible of being mastered as human knowledge of even human individuals. Now, it's immediately apparent this is the oral Rouge complaining about the classificatory bias of Aristotelian visual space.
Mm-hmm.
These separate categories
right.
are subsumed into some single principle of lawfulness.
Which he refers to as divine will,
yes.
establishing his relationship with God.
But, yes, the divine will is rational. It's human, i.e. susceptible of being mastered as human knowledge of even human individuals. You know, of even human means, even us mere humans can have God level of mastery.
Yeah.
That's definitely humanism.
Right.
So there's...
So he's saying the pluralistic view of can be unified into a single principle.
Right. And what's interesting is that as we will see, the principle is not an equation, a formula, or a platitude, like Rodney King saying, why can't we all get along? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
After the L.A. riots in 92. What's interesting, you will discover that this single principle of lawfulness is a dialogic oral participation with your immediate environment with the goal of making new improvements on the environment. It's not a static principle. It's a participatory intelligence interaction with sensory embedment
mm-hmm.
that allows you to move out of that embedment. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm wondering if would you suspect that it implies the idea of a divine plan that we're trying to mimic here on
He calls that the discrete. What is it? The discrete manifold. I have the quotes later here. I haven't read LaRouche lately, so it's a bit vague. I'm just retrieving my memories of it. But there's the continuous manifold and the discrete manifold. One was becoming and one was being. The ultimate human condition is already existent on the God level.
Mm.
And I think that is the continuous manifold. The discrete manifold is us building a world that gets to what is already existing on the, in a sense, in Plato's archetype level.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, the end entire universe was subject, that Kepler specified, the entire universe was subject to a single principle of lawfulness. Now, on superficial reading, that sounds like fascism. There's a single principle, whatever it is that LaRouche says, that is the thing that subsumes all this, say, freedom of exploration by different minds, what he calls pluralistic separate category work, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's deeper than that apparent meaning.
Mm-hmm. Did he buy into the notion of Plato's archetypes?
Yes, but he would not. This is what's interesting about LaRouche. Like McLuhan, on a certain level, McLuhan came up with a totally new view of the history of humanity and was seen as a crackpot because it was so original or off the beaten path. LaRouche's view of Plato was off the beaten path. He says the main translator of Plato, a British guy, in the end of the 19th century, forget his name, the standard text that people in Cambridge and Oxford studied, was a botched job. It's like LaRouche is saying, the Plato I'm talking about, you haven't even heard of.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the text, in Plato's writings, but a lot of it's mistranslated and botched.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was your statement, because I was explaining that?
Does he agree with the idea of Plato's archetypes?
Oh, yeah. He would say that whatever people think are archetypes, the standard image of archetypes, he probably would disagree with. He would have his own unique view of what Plato's ideal forms referred to. And I think it is what he called the continuous manifold versus the discrete manifold. Or being is perfection. That's the God's will, God's level. And human exploration and development is the discrete manifold, or what is called the process of becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And so we must study, LaRouche would say, the stages of how we got to where we got so far, because he called that the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. The more we understood how we got to where we got to, it's almost like McLuhan studying the effects and causes, then we will need to know that, and that will help us, if we know it, to develop the next more complex level. Because we're always approximating and never quite getting to the continuous manifold, which is already perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But not a static perfection. I don't know, maybe LaRouche could be seen as someone who says the universe is not finished yet.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas fundamentalists believe the universe is finished and we must follow the laws laid down.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this participatory notion of theology where humans and God are still undecided about where it's going, and we're still working it out, and we're on our way to becoming co-gods, co-creators.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sort of like the chaotic attractor idea in chaos theory.
Right. And the way he uses pluralistic is interesting. It's in quotes. Because the pluralistic is the, from McLuhan's point of view, is the new decentralization and the fragmentation of the old 19th century Gutenberg galaxy into multiverses of activity and multimedia. That chaos, and LaRouche does put down chaos theory, fits this description here. Chaos theory, or the pluralistic, is looking at decentralized effects and making a big deal out of them, exaggerating them, making the particulars important. But McLuhan would say that under electronic conditions, every particular is inflated.
Mm-hmm.
Every particular makes its own space. So it's a fine line between LaRouche retrieving visual space and visual Gutenberg hegemony, a single principle, and not being that,
mm-hmm.
and being an oral advocate.
I wonder why LaRouche would put down chaos theory. I don't think chaos theory implies there's no order. I think it implies there's chaos between levels of order. In other words, information has to restructure itself in order to, it has to realign, on the way to achieving the next level of order, it sort of becomes chaotic as a way of having to, because it can't reform itself into the next higher level of order unless it sort of breaks up and becomes chaotic in the interval.
Okay, now I don't have any quotes in my book of LaRouche commenting on chaos theory, because he didn't get into that until the late 90s. By that time, it was so prominent in the world, he had to comment on it. He was ignoring it up to that point. And so my book only goes up to 1990, 91. So I don't have any quotes in the book dealing with that, but I've read his essays like 10 years after this book was put together, where he talks about it, and it's mentioned here and there, but if I remember it right, he says that chaos theory is too addicted to models made by computers.
Oh.
And that's how the chaos theoreticians got going down in Santa Cruz, California, that area. They started looking at weird phenomena on their screens,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
The tracking of data patterns. And LaRouche would say, well, that's using a technology, an instrument of measurement, as a guide to the laws of the universe, and that's not that's silly. That's getting embedded with your instrument. And he said it's exaggerating little odd phenomena, little random things, and making a big deal out of them.
Mm.
Now, there's more we can talk about that later when we lay out a bit of McLuhan and Thompson and Croker. Then we're going to go back to that and show the figure ground of LaRouche's interaction with chaos theory. But we're just beginning with the LaRouche zone. So his critique of chaos theory is basically too embedded in the hypothesis that comes from your instruments and not looking towards the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, which gets into the individual invisible thought mentation, the patterns that you see that are not limited and produced by the results. That's why his emphasis on scientific experiment is a bit eccentric in how he interprets what is a significant experiment.
Mm-hmm.
He almost says something that proves itself. Like, he doesn't like Popper's false, you know, no theory is a scientific hypothesis unless it's falsifiable. He thinks Popper is an agent of the Warburg School, as the art people were.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I mentioned the old Warburg School?
Mm-hmm.
See, because Popper was I think he's Viennese, he's Austrian. So he was an agent of European oligarchy to Aristotelianize science. So a lot of what's respected, you know, by Wired magazine or the popular, what was Penthouse of Science magazine? I guess there's Discover
Omni.
And Omni and that kind of stuff. All that popularization of science that John Brockman is the literary agent for, Fritjof Capra, all that kind of new quantum psychology, quantum physics, quantum popularization, LaRouche saw as real garbage.
Hmm.
And so that's why people, if they just looked at a LaRouche item, a magazine article, and saw him putting that stuff down, it's like for the average college graduate, that's spitting in their face, because it's what they learned and were tested on and think is hip. And so LaRouche is so anti-environmental, he looks old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
But he does present a pretty interesting critique of the faddish levels of science.
Mm-hmm.
He critiques Stephen Hawking.
Mm.
Now, Hawking's considered, you know, by Oxford, the Aristotelian Godhead University, the continuation of the Newtonian mistake. I mean, LaRouche makes Newton seem really stupid compared to Leibniz. And you know how Galileo's considered a major scientist. Galileo's a dupe. Not very relevant compared to Kepler, as we just saw in our particular quote here.
Mm.
All the icons of traditional scientific education are dupes and flawed people in the LaRouche pantheon.
Yeah. Well, say more about why he...
Let me just finish. Hawking comes out of the... sits on the Newton chair at Oxford and is an example of bad science. Now, that... I mean, Hawking is considered a great person, a great scientist in the general culture.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where LaRouche, you know, follows a dangerous path of almost being eccentric.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to read his criticisms of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for me to consider LaRouche and think about him because I'm detached from his concerns anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So say a little more about his... He advocates Kepler and dismisses Galileo. What's that about? He says the advantage of Kepler over Galileo is qualitative, not one of degree.
Yeah, degree is, it's like you could compare Maxwell to Faraday or just different. I think there's various people like Boltzmann, various mathematicians, Boltzmann, Cauchy, Laplace, that LaRouche quotes. And he says they're all Aristotelian mathematicians. And you could compare them, and they differ in degree, but they're all within the flawed meme. So when you're dealing with Kepler, you're not comparing him to Galileo. There's apples and oranges. You can't compare them. There's a total qualitative difference because Kepler is a Platonic scientist, not even involved in the silly Aristotelian endeavor. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So Kepler came out of the Platonic tradition from Leonardo da Vinci, Tycho Brahe in transition, though he was a flawed scientist. Kepler rejected Tycho Brahe and moved on and developed his own stuff because he dealt with the five Platonic solids.
Mm-hmm.
He built on Da Vinci, and I think the other guy was Pacioli. These were the great Renaissance Platonist scientists. His key themes that he lays out in his manuscripts were plagiarized, according to LaRouche, by Galileo, who was propped up by the Venetian oligarch scientists in Italy to counter Kepler's breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. What was Kepler's breakthrough?
Well, we'll probably have to, I don't know if I have any quotes, but Kepler, he saw the gravitation principle.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the elliptical orbit of the planets. They weren't perfect spherical orbits that Copernicus and them were developing.
Mm-hmm.
He saw that there was, I think he made the prediction that there had to be another planet because of the asteroid belt or something that he picked up on. He made some pretty interesting predictions. No, maybe that was Gauss who predicted that. But Kepler, he established the elliptical orbits, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
What we attribute to Galileo was done by Kepler.
Mm.
And just as LaRouche says Newton plagiarized from Leibniz, Galileo plagiarized from the Kepler breakthrough, and Galileo was propped up by the oligarchs to defeat the effect of Kepler, and the whole imprisonment of Galileo was almost a lie that he was kept away from the public because he was it's like a rock star, you know, a crummy rock star that's imposed on the people, on the music industry, and there's not allowed much interaction with him because you realize how programmed he was by his managers, and was a top 40 operation, top 40 AM radio operation.
Well, so, didn't Gallo represent the notion that the Earth revolved around the sun and not the other way around?
No, that was Copernicus. He's the one who came up with that idea.
Okay.
Which was 100 or more years before Galileo, or maybe 75 years, whatever. I know that Copernicus is in the 1500s, and Galileo's basically in the early 1600s.
I guess I'm forgetting what Galileo became famous for.
Well, he's the one who, the popular icon, he's the guy who drops the apple on the Leaning Tower of Pisa and sort of...
That was Newton.
No, Newton had the apple land on his head. What Galileo went up in the Tower of Pisa and showed the acceleration.
Gotcha.
I think the things that he would take one size object and another tiny object, and they both end up landing at the same time or having the same acceleration, even though they had different volumes.
Right.
Now, basically, there is Galileo doing what we call a legitimate scientific experiment. But LaRouche would say that he is using sensory data to try to adduce some specific aspect of nature, a fragmented, separate little principle, whereas Kepler would see the patterns of the rotation of the planets based on his calculations from the five Platonic solids and develop a principle, the harmonious universe, I think it's called in English, but, it was a Latin phrase. He saw an ecology, an integrity in the universe from whatever he worked out, whatever data he used. He was not embedded in little particulars about how falling objects had the same acceleration rate.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Or like, so you can't necessarily invalidate Galileo or chaos mathematicians in terms of being able to come up with models that make predictions. It's just that their models somehow aren't integrated with the universe on a larger level, which gives us a grander view of things or scheme, a sense of awe of the harmony of all of nature or something.
Yeah, and that would be translated into political and artistic activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not a specialist thing of saying, oh, look, E equals MC or F equals MA. I think that's the Newton formula. Little formula tells us this, and that's what's the be-all and end-all,
yeah.
And Newton remains a guy who runs the exchequer, the Royal Mint, and remains a virgin all his life, and is just a figurehead going around and not involved with the political battles. Now,
and if you get
LaRouche's view, this what I'm saying here may not be true, but this is how LaRouche presents these guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you get too absorbed in some intellectual accomplishment, you sort of cut the head off from the heart, and you lose the beauty
right.
of the whole system.
Because LaRouche is taking science and seeing that it's in the principle Kepler shows. He says, hey, the universe, Kepler showing it's negentropic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we better topple the oligarchs. They're presenting an entropic view of the world in 1650. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he gets the scientists running for parliament.
Right.
So, and putting on concerts.
Yeah.
So, back, okay, what was I going to say? The Kepler. So, okay, Kepler. You see, it's like Kepler comes up with a single principle that can be applied all across the society.
Mm-hmm.
You can't apply the acceleration of stones off the tower that Galileo does into a political principle or artistic principle.
No, you can shoot a rocket to the moon with it, but
right. Now, there's the paradox, is that actually Newton's formulas led to new technologies, or but that's within the oligarchic battle. So it becomes a question of how unrealistic and idealistic LaRouche is being.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've talked to about the Leibniz-Newton battle with the Evergreens and with Newton and Leibniz, their spirits, and basically Newton admitted that he plagiarized from Leibniz, but he justified it because... Now, we're bringing in the Dobbs view here, right?
Yeah.
Dobbs and sources to add to this ongoing argument between Plato and Aristotle, or Galileo and Kepler. Newton said that he was the world's famous scientist. He was the god at that time. He was like the first figure of dialectics in the printed era. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Poets were big at the time of Shakespeare and that, but you're getting involved in the real deep visual bias effect of the printing press by the time of Newton, and dialectics takes over from poetic grammar and rhetoric. So he's the king of dialectics, right? So he's the new pop star of the media environment there. He's the king. So he said that because he was well known, it was best that he presented the new discovery that Leibniz had made, because Leibniz was a nobody. He was not well known, according to the spirit of Newton. And therefore, he did the right thing in terms of spreading the knowledge, because he had a bigger platform, a bigger audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Also, a lot of the stuff, he didn't really reveal it right away. It was hidden. And he explained through the Evergreens, and the Evergreens supplemented it, that back then, a nation getting new knowledge, leading to maybe making better cannons and ballistics, back then it was a Darwinian struggle, and each nation was fighting against another nation. That was militaristic, top-secret information, like having the atom bomb or something.
Yeah.
So, Newton was in a very particular, risky, dangerous, responsible political position, and he had to almost be like a media ecologist and be very careful of how this information got out, because they didn't want their competing countries in Europe to get it.
Yeah.
So LaRouche overlooks that drama, it seems. Based on what I got from them, Newton and Leibniz talking through the Evergreens.
Right.
But that's the irrelevant Dobbs source. It's a qualitative different view.
Yeah, probably a similar dynamic between Tesla and Edison, but maybe not.
Did you say maybe not?
I don't know if we if I should take us off in that direction, but I just thought that there might be a similar dynamic there.
Oh, there is, but you know that I did a panel with them.
Oh, no.
The Evergreens.
Oh, no, I haven't heard about that.
Oh, yeah, I did. Just quickly, I brought in Kepler. I evoked through the Evergreens Kepler and Einstein, Nelson Rockefeller, and Ezra Pound. I started off with, and Jesus. And I said, we're going to look at LaRouche's mind. So the Evergreens, we located LaRouche, and they're looking at his brain and all the stuff we're reading. And I said, I want these different entities to comment on LaRouche, and what do they say? So we began with Kepler, because that was LaRouche's hero, and he commented on his view of science. Then I wanted Einstein to be the later developments. Then I wanted to have the poetic science. That's Ezra Pound. Then I wanted to have economic control of science, so I brought in Nelson Rockefeller. Then I wanted to have media science, and I brought in McLuhan. So the five guys commented on LaRouche and on their own work and then started to discuss among themselves. And then the Evergreens said, oh, yeah, then I brought in what the Evergreens call the Nazarene, which is Jesus Christ. And I wanted to bring in chakric psychic science, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bring in different historical ways of doing knowledge and science compared to what LaRouche thought he was doing. So after we did Jesus, so that's six people. Kepler, Einstein, McLuhan, Rockefeller, Pound, and the Nazarene. The Evergreens said, "They when I do these panels, they sometimes they bring in someone that I haven't asked for. They said, this person should come in. They have something to offer. So the Evergreens said, we need to bring in Edison. So Edison talked. And after a while, the Evergreens said, but if you bring in Edison, you got to bring in, and they had a pause, and I said, Tesla. And they go, right. So in comes Tesla. So then Tesla gives his views, and then there's a little dialogue between Edison and Tesla, and Edison, almost for the record, apologizes to Tesla for how he kind of ripped off Tesla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I won't go into any more.
But also, you know, like Galileo, he had the platform to popularize Tesla's achievements.
Yeah, or he didn't. He only took parts of Tesla, or he basically didn't rip off Tesla, I think, if I'm remembering clearly. He distracted from Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
He got the bigger thing, and there was personal ambition and all that stuff in there.
Yeah, that's right. He kind of stopped Tesla. Yeah, he suppressed Tesla, that's right.
By hogging the limelight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By making endless inventions, you know, particular inventions, and
yeah.
Sort of beginning of being a pop star of product, like an assembly
right.
line, right? And Tesla's working on another qualitative level, a whole different level of invention.
Right.
So the Evergreens didn't go into the way Newton was in relation to Leibniz of their period, their time, and how Newton was a bigger platform. There was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but and this was done in 95, you know, 11 years ago, there was another level of opposition between Tesla and Edison. Not on the same level platform. It was more like Edison jumped the gun and Morgan could use him. Morgan wanted financial stuff, right?
Yeah.
Financial product.
Well, Tesla told Morgan he could give everybody free energy, and Morgan destroyed him at that point.
Yeah, he said, well, that's got nothing to do with visual space. You know, we live in a world of visual space, Morgan maintained.
Yeah.
So, let's see.
So that finishes up this first
this
page.
Slide?
Yeah. Well, the first page of LaRouche here. The only follow up comment I wanted to make before we jump to McLuhan is that I'll bet LaRouche parts company with Plato in some areas of knowledge, because Plato talked about Atlantis, and I don't think LaRouche believes in Atlantis.
Yes, he does.
He does?
Yes, he... LaRouche says that there were very advanced civilizations before Athens.
No.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yes.
I figured he would lump that in with what he considers to be, you know, the wacky metaphysical group.
Oh, yeah, he doesn't believe in the New Age fantasizing about Atlantis.
Mm.
But LaRouche says that the maritime civilizations,
mm-hmm.
what he calls the Ionian Peninsula part of Greece, that there were great scientists there, and that they came out of Egypt and some whatever was developed in Egypt, and Moses carried that tradition over, he says.
Oh.
And then that was picked up by Pythagoras.
Oh, wow.
And then Pythagoras, then to the Platonic school. He stretches it back, but he says that there is evidence that there was a very advanced civilization before recorded history.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks that's what Plato's referring to when with the Atlantis myth or Atlantis evidence.
Right.
I mean, LaRouche probably wouldn't agree with the description of Atlantis that comes through Blavatsky and the Theosophist sources.
Right.
But LaRouche, using his principles, he says that the Greek myths of the gods of Olympus,
mm-hmm.
that the gods were actual terrible oligarchs, people who, oligarchic kind of people, who suppressed the advanced civilization before Greece. And they take over and create this bestial, mythic, mythological kind of knowledge.
Yeah.
And oral culture that then becomes folklore in Greece, you know, through Homer and that. But
yeah.
The Olympians actually referred to bad destroyers, human destroyers of this advanced culture that Plato is trying to retrieve.
Mm.
Interesting,
That is fascinating.
And you got to read LaRouche to find that. I mean, that's an obscure essay he wrote about 1980. I have it. And he dwelt with that angle. LaRouche is like McLuhan. I mean, he would write, he'd take a particular issue, write an essay, then never address it again and go on and write an essay about another part of our history or another topic. And so you got to read his whole work to see all the things that he encyclopedically wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's almost what I call Gurdjieffian art, objective art. They know exactly what effect they want to do with that particular essay, and then they make it. Then they go on to create another effect and target a different audience. Now, this is what's interesting about LaRouche, Thompson, Croker, and McLuhan, is they are all trivialists and quadrivialists. They're rhetoricians, dialectics, grammarians, astronomers. They actually cover the whole thing because they're polymaths, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in the, maybe it was last week, these divisions, dialectic versus rhetorical, are cartoon outlines presented by the Android meme. Because remember, all these guys are going to get, all their great efforts are subsumed by the Android meme.
Yeah.
By Dobbs.
Yeah. And they don't seem to recognize it. Well, probably McLuhan did. Well,
no, they,
let's McLuhan, say, I bet LaRouche doesn't, but the other guys do.
Well, I was quiet back then. I was propping them up, and this is in the 70s and 60s. I was creating their public profile for my own particular agenda to show up later.
Hmm.
Basically, I mean, LaRouche is still alive, and we've had some interesting interviews, but I can't say he knows what I'm doing or understands it.
No. I don't think so. The interviews that you've done with him pretty much are a way of allowing him to present his views. It's not so much that
it's not a dialogue.
Yeah, it's not a dialogue.
And it's a way of countering the TV body image of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cartoon view that the Android Mean gives of him.
Right.
And show, and it usually works. People hear those interviews, they go, wow, I didn't know LaRouche knew all that stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, we're getting near the end of this side, right?
Yeah.
So what we should do is, I want to just read the first quote on the next page, page 5, from McLuhan. And it, are we still on tape?
Yeah.
It says, and this is from, what's GV, my source GV, in the back I look at the index which gives the source of the quote. It's from The Global Village, subtitled Transformations in World Life and Media in the 21st Century, written by McLuhan and his colleague Bruce Powers, who was an ex-CIA guy. The book came out in 1989 after McLuhan died, but they worked on it in the 70s. The quote is, spoken word is mirror of the mind, colon, you know, punctuation. Canon is mirror of the voice, when one voice repeats or reflects what another has stated. So I'll read that again. Spoken word is mirror of the mind. Canon is mirror of the voice, when one voice repeats or reflects what another has stated. That's a pretty interesting statement, quite a different topic than what we've been dealing with in LaRouche.
Making this distinction there between the speech, the voice speech, and then the canon being the alphabetic written, written word.
Yeah, repeat to reflect what another has stated. And it could be pre-literate, could be still in oral culture, but I think it is largely what another has stated, and it has to be repeated or matched with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the oral culture doesn't emphasize matching as much as making.
Mm-hmm.
Dialectical hallucination or improvisation on each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say we're going to go into that. I don't want to go into explore it, but just show you what's coming.
Yeah.
Let me just read a couple of quotes here for people to think about. So that's the first quote. The next quote is from Cliched Archetype, a book he put out in 1970. McLuhan is saying, there is a fascinating example in John Milton's Paradise Lost of the process of intellectual anesthesia. Milton's problem, which is that of orthodox theology, is to explain how Satan, who has supreme created intelligence, should immediately be able to intuit the results of any sin. Therefore, the problem is, how can he be said to commit sin and be of high order of intelligence? I would say, because intelligence is something that's not fooled, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not numbed, not suffering intellectual anesthesia. Milton solved this problem wittily by showing how Satan uses language to obscure his thinking. There's McLuhan talking about the medium getting in the way of thinking.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to contrast that with all the talk about thinking and creative mentation that we see on the opposite page from LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
Then here's the quote.